Hello, welcome to Now You've Seen It, a podcast that endeavours to fill the holes in your essential movie viewing history. I'm Paul Gisby, your host for this episode, in which we will be featuring the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey. But first, let's just do some introductions. Because joining me today, we have two of our regular panellists in alphabetical order, speaking from a small town north of Seattle, and also the co-host of Fairweather Friends, the Fairweather Friends podcast, we have Matt. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Paul. Thanks.
And after M, we have P for Peter, and Peter is hailing from the Maritimes Hub City. Peter is a musician, photographer, and Photoshop whiz, and he also has produced the theme music for the Overcast podcast and was host of two different app review podcasts, and he made the logo for this show. So, hi, Peter.
Hello.
Who's just been telling us that he's been barbecuing at -2°C, which is very interesting. Last but not least on our introductions, certainly not least, I'm delighted to welcome Brefni Early, author, speaker, podcaster, and world cycle race winner. A very warm NYSI welcome to you, Brefni.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Now, I have to say, before we get into the movie, I just have to back up a little bit. World cycle race winner, you just throw that in as a sort of description. I looked it up, actually. This is quite impressive. This is something you did. It was 18,000 miles, 25 countries, 6 continents.
Yeah, well, that was the plan. It didn't quite work out like that. The numbers are quite similar. It's 18,000 miles, yes. It would be 27, 28 countries. I came kind of close to some, so I dipped in for lunch maybe in Greece or an overnight in Croatia. But yeah, it was a phenomenal 16 months of my life back in about 2014, 2015. Yeah. And I wasn't a cyclist at all, and I just decided I'm going to set myself this massive challenge and found myself on the start line of that event, and 16 months later became the most unlikely winner of the event when I became the only person to finish, which was kind of weird and cool at the same time.
Very cool, I'd say. I'm sorry, Peter, you lost the gold star. Barbecuing at -2 is sort of paling into insignificance now. Anyway, okay. Thanks for that, Brefni. Okay, let's move on to the topic of conversation. So, now you've seen it. The idea is that we review a movie with two panelists and a host and a guest. And the rule is that the guest chooses a movie that they have not seen before, and it's a movie from our list of top. Is it 500? I'm not sure how many we've got on the list now, but a lot of top movies and classics. So let me start. First of all, Brefni, are you a big movie watcher?
I am, yeah. I love the cinema. Can't get enough in terms of movies. I'd go to the cinema. I love going to the cinema on my own, mid-afternoon, coming out when it's still daylight. In college, myself and a friend would spend Saturday afternoons sometimes if we had nothing else on. We'd go to a movie at 12, just jump into another one at 2, another one at 4, another one at 6. We might do 4 or 5 movies in a day, and we probably only paid for the first one, so we'd move around from theater to theater. But no, it was great, and I even now I don't get out to the cinema as often as I'd like to now, but I do still like to get out and see some of the blockbusters, maybe some of the local indies that are made here in Ireland, and yeah, just any movie, doesn't matter what it is, I enjoy it.
Brilliant. And sci-fi?
Not quite all. I don't quite enjoy all of it, because we're going to talk about that in a bit more. Sci-fi, some bits of it I like. Wouldn't have been a Star Trek fan, but love Star Wars, if that makes sense. So as long as sci-fi is fine, as long as there's a story through it, would be a fan. Have to have a bit of a story just to keep your attention.
Yeah, okay. And so why did you choose 2001 from the list?
It was one I always thought, I must see that, it's supposed to be a classic, and I really knew little to nothing about it except that it was sci-fi. And I suppose there was 4 or 5 movies that popped out to me, and I know when we chatted online back a few weeks ago now, this was the one that we kind of settled on, and I'm glad I watched it, but...
We'll get to that. But so, and then the other question is, so how come you hadn't seen it before if it was such a classic and you being such a movie buff?
Probably because it was sci-fi, and I would have, in my head, I would have put it as an old school sci-fi, very basic special effects or non-existent special effects, just kind of camera trickery, really. I just didn't really get around to it, I suppose.
Right. Yeah. I have to say, I think certainly one of the reasons. It's not easy to watch, actually. It's not, certainly this side of the Atlantic, it takes a little bit of tracking down, but good. Okay, we're going to take a short break now, but when we get back, we'll be talking with Breffni and our panelists and find out what they thought about 2001 A Space Odyssey. When it was released, the poster for 2001 A Space Odyssey described it as an epic drama of adventure and exploration, which is pretty uninformative. So let's just take a listen to a trailer we've put together to give us a better overview.
In a world, the world is Earth. Millions of years ago, at the dawn of man, a water rights dispute leads one tribe to develop weapons. Then,
in the year 2001,
a man flies to a space station full of companies no one has seen since.
The year 2000!
He makes a FaceTime call to his daughter, then lies to the Russians.
Sorry, Reggie.
Then heads to the moon. Then there's a trip to Jupiter with jogging, chess, spacewalks, and a minor computer glitch, including karaoke. Then an acid trip from Stanley Kubrick, director of Dr. Strangelove, A Clockwork Orange, and The Shining comes one of his movies.
2001!
A Space Odyssey.
When the movie came out, the critical response was, well, let's say it was quite polarized. And let's read you some quotes from the Times. It was described as monumentally unimaginative, morally pretentious, intellectually obscure, and inordinately long, a film out of control. And Rock Hudson apparently walked out of the screening and was heard to mutter, "This is bullshit." However, there were other people who said, "Succeeds magnificently on a cosmic scale. The world's most extraordinary film. Nothing like it has ever been shown in Boston before, or anywhere else for that matter. Some kind of great film and an unforgettable endeavour." So, let me start with you, Breffni. Where do you sit on the review spectrum? BS or some kind of great film and an unforgettable endeavour?
Well, it's unforgettable, but I'm definitely with Rock Hudson on this one. I've only ever walked out of one movie, and that was The Beach, and this would be number two. I struggled. It took me 3 attempts to get through this movie. I literally finished it about 15 minutes before we sat down to have this chat because I had to get through it. No, this is an absolute no for me.
Oh, okay.
Did you go through the 10 minutes of blank screen at the beginning and then the end of the original?
I did it at the beginning. I thought there was a mistake. I just thought there's noise, blank, dark screen. Until you said that, I thought it was just an issue I had with my copy of the film. It was just not good. The whole thing was just too slow. The pace, they took 6 minutes to say what could have been done in, I don't know, 10 seconds. Like, you look at something like Star Wars back in the day, and it would have been done in a fraction of the time that it took to do just these endless. Now, they're epic. The cinematography for the time 51 years ago was phenomenal. And some of the special effects, given what would have been available at the time, are impressive even now. But the story was virtually non-existent. And I got bored repeatedly through it. It's one of the worst movies I've ever seen of all time.
I said it was a 30-minute story crammed into a 2.5-hour movie.
Mm-hmm. You found 30 minutes? 13 minutes, maybe.
Okay, Matt, what do you think?
I was similar. I've kind of felt bad. I watched it a second time after reading reviews and more about the themes and things, and it was a little more interesting after reading about it. But yeah, watching it with no real knowledge going in, it was slow and boring. Mm-hmm.
So, Peter, where are you on the spectrum, though? Are you a BS guy or a Great Endeavor guy?
I remember another podcast talking about the Christopher Reeve Superman and how the hosts of that were sort of like, well, the flying looked fake, but up to that point it hadn't been done. So similarly, they used models just like they did in Star Wars and Star Trek, and for the time, it's the first time to do it, and you want to show off what you can do. But the longer, like, it was all right for the first showing, but you could probably cut it down a bit. So it's impressive what they did for what they had, But like I said, it is half hour or 16 minutes, whatever, of story in a 2.5 hour movie. And like at one point, like before the acid trip, I go, okay, it's probably almost over. And I look, and it's like 45 minutes left. And I go, what? But, and then there's the 10 minutes at the end, which when I first went to see it, I thought something was wrong with the feed. I was looking on the streaming service. So I stopped it, started again, and it's still black. So I did a Google search. Oh, yes, with the initial 10 minutes of blank screen, because apparently I get a feeling he was trying to make it like a musical, you know, like where you have an overture.
Yeah.
Where, but the thing is, they only had like 4 different musical pieces in the whole movie. So it's not like a variation of the themes that they just, well, we'll play that one now. And it's like, I used to work retail, and you'd have like 8 songs that they'd play over and over and over and over again. So like, I was sort of like that. So I'm more now on the bullshit side. Back then, it would be a little bit closer to brilliant, but not so much.
Yeah. I think it took about 6 or maybe 25 minutes for the first bit of dialogue in the movie. Like, please, just get to something. Tell me what's going on. I hadn't, no more than Peter, I hadn't read anything about it. I purposely had decided I was going to leave it as late as possible to watch it so that it would be fresh. I wouldn't read any reviews. I did in the last 15 minutes after I watched it, and I was like, how can that be on a list of classics? And some of the stuff I read and some of the people who backed it and liked it and still talk about it as a classic, I'm like, I respect the work that they've done off the back of it, yes. So the likes of Star Wars and all the other movies that they've been involved in since, brilliant stuff, some phenomenal, real classics, good stories, well shot, well structured, well cast. But this was just, yeah, I don't know how to get any more negative than I already have, and I don't really like being negative. I like movies. I'll watch any kind of rubbish. Like, I'll watch a teen movie, I'll watch a thriller, I'll watch whatever, rom-com, it doesn't bother me. I'll just lose myself in the story for an hour and a half. But this was a struggle.
Well, you're right that there's some pretty luminary figures who've said it was amazing. I mean, Christopher Nolan, I think he said it pretty much inspired his movie career. I mean, it really, really, you know, got him going, and was one of the most important movies for him. So, I mean,
was he sober when he watched it, though?
Well, yeah, it's funny you should mention that, but I don't know if you read about what happened when it came out, but initially it bombed when it first was being shown, and the returns from the first weekend were very poor. And I think was it an MGM movie? The bosses of the studio were all for pulling it. And then they started to get messages from some key distributors saying, well, hang on a minute, actually. We're starting to get some audiences drifting in. There's some guys coming. They tend to all sit in a little knot at the front. There's a small number of them, one showing, and then there's a larger number next. And that's when the cult following started. And it was around the time that psychedelia and LSD and all that kind of stuff was very fashionable. And at one point it was described as the movie that people enjoyed watching after they had smoked funny cigarettes, was one description of it. So yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe that's the whole idea. But okay, so I'm sort of feeling I've got to defend the Great Endeavour side a bit to keep the conversation rolling. I mean, can we just explore why they might have thought it was so great, though? Why people were sort of falling over themselves to say it was amazing?
I mean, for 1968, some of those special effects must have been crazy. The anti-gravity stuff, I thought, was pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. There's a documentary, actually, you can catch, which is on Amazon, about the making of it, and it talks about all that kind of stuff, and it was very groundbreaking. And how they did the bit where he's running around the space station, but they actually built a set that rotated. So he's actually running on the spot and the thing is rotating around him.
And earlier in the movie, the girl, I can't remember the character's name, but she walks right around kind of 180 degrees around the room.
Yeah.
And it's quite clear they've rotated the set around her. It felt like I was watching the kind of, I suppose, even looking at more modern stuff that might have evolved from that. I was talking today to a friend about Jamiroquai, their video for Virtual Insanity, and it's the same kind of idea. He's dancing more or less in the same space, and the house moves around him. Like that back 50 years ago, like that was revolutionary when Jamiroquai did it in the 90s. This was 30 years before that. Like some of the special effects, I have to say, were impressive. And the vast sheer size of some of the shots was great. It just could have been 20 seconds rather than 15 minutes.
And if Jamiroquai is too modern for some of us, 10 years earlier, it was Lionel Richie with Dancing on the Ceiling, where they had the upside down room and moving around, or even 20 years before that.
You're Batman, showing your age now.
Batman and Robin climbing up the side of the building. They just got to move the camera sideways, and it looks.
Yeah, it worked.
Yeah.
That reminds me a bit, though, of the skit in Monty Python where they scale the high street, if you've seen that one.
Yeah.
Where they do the same thing, except they don't bother to move the camera and they have people walking past, looking at them, thinking, what do they do?
Yeah.
So that's quite amusing. I mean, what about the idea, though, that some people have put forward that, you know, it's not a movie that you watch in the same way that you might watch Back to the Future, where you're expecting a rolling plot that keeps bowling along. And it's more like looking at abstract art, and that it draws you in and allows you to muse upon what it means and work it out for yourself. I mean, do you not get that point?
I mean, that's where when I read those themes that other people see when they watch it the first time, it was kind of interesting to watch it back.
Yeah.
But I don't see movies. I don't know. I guess I'm not a super analytical when I watch movies.
No? Well, why should you do that?
I did like the concept of who's in control. Is it humans? Is it computers? Where does that go? And I suppose looking back now at 50 years later, in terms of how we're all talking to each other via computers, there's very little artificial intelligence in there at the moment, particularly in this encounter where we're all in different parts of the world talking to each other at the same time in real time. And I know you made a joke about FaceTime earlier, Peter, like in terms of what he did in that trailer, but that's the reality, is that they predicted technology that now exists that we take for granted. And I suppose you mentioned Back to the Future as well, Paul, is that those movies share that technology, and they were 20 years, maybe 20, 25 years apart, maybe a bit less, and now 30 years later, we take that for granted.
Yeah. So how do people think it holds up, though, as a way of predicting the future? Because if you watch sci-fi movies, some sci-fi movies you look at, and they attempted to predict the future, and they, you know, it looks really cranky because it's just so not like that. I mean, the classic thing that you see is the computers they have are all black screens with green text on them, and that's as far as it went. But what do you think about 2001? Do you think it holds up well, or has it got hugely dated in terms of what it was predicting?
I was not taken aback, but I thought it kind of funny that Hal was bragging that him and his twin computer have never had an error. And knowing what we know about computers now, that's really not something you're gonna tout, because it's people that are programming it, and maybe someone forgot a comma or a semicolon someplace, and it's thoroughly throws everything off.
Mm. But doesn't Hal actually say that, though, at one point, doesn't he? When he's admitted that there is an error, he says, well, it'd be human error.
Yeah. The thing I was saying before we started, I was reading about it, and apparently the idea behind Hal doing what he did was that he doesn't have errors, but he knew what the secret mission of, is it the Voyager or the Discovery, had. But he was told not to tell the humans, so much like the Star Trek episode with the old Earth probe that gained sentience again with an AI, and they messed it up with a feedback loop of illogical stuff.
Yeah,
that's what caused Hal to basically go crazy, because he knew he was putting the humans in danger, but he was told not to tell them and like act like nothing's wrong. which sort of basically gave him a nervous breakdown.
Mm. Yeah.
So, I mean, how do we think it... Because I was quite impressed, actually, that the way Hal spoke, and I thought it didn't seem that far away from how people are imagining AI at the moment. I mean, it didn't exactly sound like Alexa, but it could have been Alexa's camp uncle.
Yeah, well, that's fair enough. I think, looking back at it, I thought, like, the way it's open the door, close the door, rotate the pod, all that sort of stuff that happens through the movie, we do that nowadays, whether it's clapping your hands to turn off lights in rooms. Now, I don't have it in my house, but certain people do have it. That kind of technology, or Alexa, where it's play a certain song, do this, do that. That technology is becoming more and more commonplace as we go along. Mm. And you're right, it's not very different to how it was depicted in the movie 51 years ago. Like, Kubrick, as a director and as a kind of a filmmaker, has always kind of pushed those boundaries, I think. And I suppose he's predicted the future in a couple of ways across a couple of his movies. Like, even I think in one of my favorite movies of his was Dr. Strangelove, and you see the kind of the atomic bomb, and it was kind of a joke at the time, but now we look and how far are we away from a megalomaniac just deciding, hey, I'm gonna just blow the whole world up? And like, can any one of us really say that that's not a possibility at the moment?
Yeah. No, I agree. Funnily enough, I watched Strangelove a few weeks ago, and I was struck by how that felt really modern. It felt really up to date, and a bit sort of scary. So, you're open to Kubrick then, Breffni? I mean, you're not anti Stanley.
No, not at all. Like, there's a couple of his movies that would be on my classics list. I would have Doctor Strangelove as one of my favorites of all time. I did quite enjoy Spartacus back in the day, the old version of that before they made that, was it naughty's kind of sexed up TV series, but the old movie was pretty good. The Shining, I'm not great in those kind of movies, I'll be honest, but I did watch it, I did enjoy it, freaked the hell out of me as a teenager. Mm. Eyes Wide Shut, I probably watched as a teenager for different reasons, but quite enjoyed the movie. So I liked, but again, there was a whole, that was weird, but there was a story through it. And I suppose once there's a narrative, I kind of feel like you can follow that and understand what characters are going through. It's just, there was too much of nothing in the movie we looked at for this show. It was just, we're not going to get back to the negativity of that. But yeah, no, Kubrick as a director, as a filmmaker, I would support a lot of stuff he does. Now, I haven't seen Lolita, but I've seen the Jeremy Irons version of it 30 years later. It's a great story. It's a taboo story, and he was pushing the envelope, as we mentioned already, back then in the 60s, probably further than most people would even push it now. Like, the idea of coming out and making a movie about a man falling in love with basically an adopted teenage daughter would not go down well now, but he pushed that boundary in the 60s, when in the very early 60s, before even Beatlemania or any of that stuff came on. And I think he did push boundaries. He did create opportunities for the people coming after him to really indulge, whether it was special effects or sci-fi or whatever it might have been. But like, you got to love Peter Sellers and Dr. Strangelove. It's got to be one of the best performances of all time.
Yeah,
well, all of his performances in that movie.
Yeah, because that's one of the questions I had actually was about the acting, and then I thought, well, okay, was there any?
Well, I had to actually go and look up who the actors were, because I'm like, and I did a bit of research into who they were, and I'm like, I don't think I've seen you in anything else. I've seen you in nothing else. I've seen you in nothing else. Now, there was a couple of little hits that I kind of recognized vaguely, but like, these were non-superstars. Although, for some funny reason, everybody's still alive. Like, nearly the entire cast is still alive 51 years later. They all lived into their 80s or 90s or are still alive. That's interesting. I thought that was kind of weird.
Ooh. Now, with the promo that we played, the little joke about, sorry, Reggie, the guy that played the Russian scientist is Richard Rossiter, I think?
Leonard Rossiter. Is his name?
Leonard Rossiter, yeah. Who was in the British series of Rise and Fall Original Perrin, and that was sort of a thing.
Absolutely was, yeah.
Yeah.
He's dead, unfortunately, so he has gone. But
But he was he was 85 or 90 before he died.
Oh, he was? Absolutely, yeah. So 2001 is good for your health, then? Keeps you going a long time?
Except for the director. As we hear in the documentary, he died before 2001 came around.
Yeah, so he never saw it. So come and help me here, Peter and Matt. Are we writing this off, then, as just some weird experiment that's only liked by geeks in the industry because of the technical stuff it taught them, or has it got any other positive redeeming features that we should be focusing on?
Like I said, I think those good themes, the whole that obelisk kind of sparking evolution a little faster, and things like that, but it took a long time to say all those things, like you said.
I came up with the thing. It's like, you know, in like those rom-com movies with, oh, she's leaving on an airplane, I gotta go to the airport, and there's a cut and he arrives at the airport. Well, this is where, oh, she's going, I gotta stop her. So he goes, gets his car keys, goes out the room, goes down the hallway, puts his shoes on, gets in the car, goes down the street, stops at the light, looks both ways, goes up, gets on the highway,
and stops for coffee,
on and so on. Yeah, stop. Yeah, and a little bit of a traffic congestion, and yeah, so goes along again with the 16 minutes of story in a 2-hour thing. But yeah, it. But like I said, this is, if they hadn't figured out how to do this thing, we would never have gotten Star Wars, because it's the same. And I think from that documentary that you and Paul and I watched, I'm pretty sure that guy that moved from Canada that had worked for the National Film Board went to there. I'm pretty sure Douglas Turnbull.
Yeah.
I think that's his name. He was part of the team that helped founded ILM. I'm pretty sure the Industrial Light and Magic.
Right.
So there wouldn't have been a Star Wars wouldn't have been, well, probably wouldn't have been done. If not done, if it was done, it wouldn't be as well. And like all these multiple special effects companies that are around working on movies wouldn't be there.
Yep.
So that's sort of like a demo reel of what could be done. And that's why they stretched it out, because look, no one's ever done it again. See, there's no wires. And anyway, but what I think this movie would be best for is like a house party, like a get together, not like a rave, but like have it on like multiple screens. So people doing, and they say, oh, that looks interesting, and watch it for a bit and then go do something else.
Right.
It's kind of hard to, like, this was the first time I actually watched it all the way through. It was on CBC about, must have been 25 years ago, and I went, sat down on the Sunday that it was on to watch it, and I think I might have gotten just past the monkeys, and I did something else.
Right.
I was going to say, I might recommend it to my friends who enjoy those special cigarettes you mentioned earlier, Paul.
Yeah.
Say, hey, maybe throw one on after a few of those and see if you like it.
Yeah.
Jazz cigarettes.
Yeah, remind me not to go to any of your parties, Peter. That's what I'm going to say. Now, I have to say, though, can we have a mention, though, for the music? Because I don't know what it is, but every time Blue Danube came on, I wanted to get up and just waltz around the room. And it's like, it's a spectacular piece of music. And it really is. It just pulls in everything. As bad as the movie was, there were sparks in it that I really did enjoy. And I think the soundtrack, even though it was just the same two or three or four songs repeated over and over again, and random noises at weird times, but when the music did come in, I think the music they picked was perfect where the music plays, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and in fact, there was a score written for it, but Kubrick rejected it in the end, and he put that other music on. And I agree with you. I think the Blue Danube works particularly well. Although I have to say, the main theme, also Spake Zarathustra. I mean, that's pretty good as well. It's pretty awesome. That, you know, duh, 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 duh. He says, mimicking it very badly. The thing about the
no, go on, keep going. It was good.
Yeah,
it was good.
Yeah, yeah, right. Okay, you've obviously had one of those cigarettes. but the thing was that Qubit rejected the soundtrack, and the guy that wrote the music didn't know until the screening. So he went on along to the big opening, and his music wasn't there. So he was an interesting guy. But I think you're right. The music was pretty impressive. So from what you're saying, and none of you have seen this movie in a cinema. You've all seen it on smaller screens.
Yep.
Yes, that's true.
Because I actually saw it when it was re-released in 1974. I didn't see it when it came out in 68, as I was only 11 then. But I did see it in 74 or 75 in a cinema. And it was a big Odeon cinema with some of the first Dolby surround sound type speakers. And I have to say, that adds something else to it. It went on and on. It was big, but it was very new, and it was certainly a completely new experience for me to see that kind of thing in a cinema. And with all the sound playing on the big speakers and also the huge wide screen, it was a bit more of an absorbing experience. I seem to remember. I didn't leave. I did see it all the way through. I do remember it feeling like it was pretty long, but I think maybe you lose some of that if you see it on a small screen.
Yeah, that's probably fair. I think some movies just work on a big screen. I think if this is going to work anywhere, the bigger the screen, I think the real scale of the imagery. I watched it on a laptop, so the screen was even smaller than the television. So I would imagine a lot of the definition that would be there in those just epic space shots would have been amazing.
Yeah.
But yeah, you do lose that. And I kind of realized that as I was watching it, but I just thought, yeah, at that stage, I was so bored, I just didn't care, to be honest.
Okay, I think we're cycling around. So, Peter, Matt, anything else you wanted to say? Any particular, any other bits you want to defend?
Not so much defend, but I'm wondering whether, you know, Tim Conway from the Carol Burnett Show, whether he got the idea for the old man, the one to go really slow, from what happens to Dave.
Right,
you know, when he's in the hotel room, like, doing things, well, I guess we're spoiling. Dave goes through a 20-minute acid trip, which looks straight from a Who concert in, like, 1976, and ends up in a the documentary said it's sort of like the cage from Star Trek, where it's something that he would have likely stayed in, like at a big hotel, and he sees himself as an old man, and he's eating, which is another thing that happens through the movie. It seems to be a thing, like a theme, because on the shuttle to the space station, the guy had his full dinner in, like, his sippy cups or juice boxes. And then it's Dave as an old man eating, I guess, mashed potatoes and things. But like I said, I'm getting a tangent there, but I'm wondering if Tim Conway saw that and figured, oh, that's a character I could play. But anyway.
Yeah, another spin-off, so it's spinning things off. Matt, anything else to add?
Just defending the movie, I don't know. I found some interesting facts and things about it that were, I think it was more fun reading about stuff that happened with Stanley Kubrick and in the movie than it was watching it.
Yeah, give us some of that then.
So he actually went to Lloyd's of London and tried to take out alien insurance. According to Ink Tank, he was worried.
What would that cover?
Well, so he was worried that aliens would be discovered before it was released, and that the movie would just be obsolete. So he wanted the insurance policy to negate any losses, potential losses.
Wow.
So if aliens had been discovered, he would have been covered. But it didn't sound like they issued a policy for that.
Wow.
Although Arthur C. Clarke did say that the night that they decided to make the movie and they had the story down, they went out on the balcony of the hotel they were at, and they saw a light go up in the sky and hover for a couple minutes and then take off. So he figured, oh, the aliens gave him the idea to make the movie.
Yeah. He said he'd seen lots of things that could have been UFOs, but there'd always been good explanations, but there wasn't one for that one, so you never know. Yeah. Okay. Anything else, Matt?
There's also, the movie was actually longer, the original, when it first was sent out. And they have the other 17 minutes of footage, and it's debated whether they should release that, Warner Brothers.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of the stuff as well, because he did take some bits out, and he kept all the models and everything. And then as he got towards the end of his life, he demanded that they all be burned. And so most of the old footage, and then all the artwork and a lot of the models and things have been destroyed. A tiny little bit's been left, apparently, but no one knows exactly where it is. But yeah,
Warner Brothers has it in their vault, according to slashfilm.com.
Right. So they're going to probably release it one day for some big to do. Okay, well, thank you, gentlemen. Time is moving on, so we need to wrap our discussion about the movie itself, and we do need to take another break. When we come back, we'll be moving the conversation on, and we'll be giving it a score, the movie a score, and as well as looking at a challenge that I set everybody before we began the show. So stay with us. Okay, now part of Now You've Seen It, this particular part of the show is called the Host Special Segment, where each week the host decides on a specific topic or question to discuss that's connected to the movie, but is a bit different from what we've discussed so far. And for this episode, I chose to set the panelists and our guests the challenge, which is as follows. All futuristic sci-fi movies make predictions about the future, not least the types of new technology that might exist. What would be your predictions for new gadgets that you would put into your futuristic movie? Breffni, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, I really struggle with this. So many things going through my head. I was thinking about time machines from, say, Time Traveler or Back to the Future. And I think for me, it's got to be, in terms of a new technology, I don't know, something that maybe cooks your dinner for you that you don't even have to think about. It just appears. But I'd like that in my own life. But I think in real terms, I think it's got to be some sort of bi-location thing where you can be in two locations at the one time. I'm not sure how that would work, but that you can literally be at work and at whatever you want to be at the same time. I think that some sort of technology, how that works, I don't know. My imagination probably isn't strong enough for that. But I think something along those lines where you can literally be in two places at the one time. It might be a hologram-based thing, like, say, in the most recent Star Wars where Luke appears, and it's obviously him. He's in a different location, but he appears, and he's tangible. He's there. He can have a conversation. He can touch him. Or it could be along the terms of Star Trek. I know I said I didn't like Star Trek earlier, and I don't, but that technology where it just beam me up and you can just disappear to somewhere else, which, again, was a pretty good science fiction, special effect that would have been not that long after 68, really. And, yeah, something like that, by location or beamed around the world easily. Right. I don't know. I don't know how that will pan out.
Right. In a more sort of casual way than you do in Star Trek, because it's a big deal in Star Trek. You know, they go down to the transporter room and so forth. You're thinking of something that everybody just do, like, you know, they catch a bus or something.
Or you make a phone call. So you ring that location, right, and you travel with it. That would be kind of cool. If you could go to Google Maps and just double tap on a place and all of a sudden you're there, that would be pretty sweet.
Yeah. Okay. Matt, Peter, who wants to go next?
Did Matt drop out? Maybe along those lines that finally getting Hyperloop, so which will not instantaneous travel, but like faster than you usually can, like even faster than airplanes through pneumatic tubes, would be a thing that would be good, cutting down on road traffic and stuff like that.
Yeah. Transport stuff. Matt.
Well, shoot, I actually got lost there for a minute, but did you just say tubes? I think you took mine,
yeah.
Peter.
No, the Hyperloop?
Yeah, tube technology I've always had a fascination with. I think it would be awesome and hilarious at the same
Guy in charge of the internet that said, you know, the internet's not a truck, it's a bunch of tubes. Well, let's travel tubes.
Yeah.
Like Minority Report.
Is that what they do? I've not seen that one.
Yeah, at the start of Minority Report, they move around the world in these capsules that just go in tubes. Like, that would be pretty sweet.
Yeah. So I set this challenge and I thought it would be pretty straightforward. And I thought, okay, I better think of something myself. And then I struggled, like I think all of you did. And I thought, do you know what? All the easy stuff has already been done. You know, I mean, like they you know, in 68 they predicted FaceTime, and that was a pretty obvious one. I remember seeing years before they became common, a guy in Osaka in Japan using a video phone and just being blown away and thinking, wow, that was absolutely amazing. So that's been done. And the travel one, I think, yeah, you're talking about variations, but there are other ideas. I actually cheated a little bit and went online and said, okay, you know, what does the internet think? And I got several sites that 20 amazing gadgets to come or 100 gadgets to come. None of them were actually that much different from what we've got now. They were variations on things. It was all like, you know, someone's invented an app for that. So that's quite interesting that we've got to that stage where it's quite difficult to predict the groundbreaking stuff. It'll probably have to be completely different. The only thing I did come up with was I wondered about some kind of mind projection thing, you know, where you could actually, if you've got a picture in your head, the only way you can really get it out is you could either draw it or you could describe it. But if you could put some kind of electrodes on your, you know, electrical connections on your head so that you could actually project the image that you were imagining out in some way, that might be quite cool.
I think that's in Minority Report as well.
Oh, well, I've beaten to that one. Okay, well, then there's another one. I went a bit further, which was, all right, well, what other things are there in your head that you can't connect? And I thought, well, you can't communicate exactly a smell. So if you have a smell memory of something that smells, could you maybe then say, well, it smells like this, and then you could pass this smell connection. So, and if you could do that, you get, you know, people have talked about smell-o-vision, but this would be communicating all those things that you, it's actually quite difficult to communicate other than via words. So
that was why would you want to do that?
I think
you're thinking roses and fresh cut grass, and all every teenage boy in the world is thinking is, I'm going to send poo and farts.
Absolutely. Don't worry. I did actually go there as well. So that was the whole thing. The thing is, just because the technology doesn't have a use, that doesn't mean you shouldn't invent it. I mean, you know, they invented lasers and they hung around for 25 years before anyone found a real use for them. And
There was a company a decade or so ago that wanted to add smell-o-vision to movies.
Yeah.
They'd have a basically different vials with components that, okay, it's like you're cut grass and the smell of the gasoline from the mower, and they shoot it out to increase the experience, probably around the same time that 3D came back. So it's like, oh, it was like I'm in it. Oh, and I smell the pie cooking, or I can smell the ocean for that ship going across the screen right now. So it that's a good possibility too. It's just, it would to have it for everything might even become too much of a information overload for people.
Yeah.
Like even now with like 3D goggles and that, people have getting themselves in trouble because they're feeling like they're actually in the space, and then they take the mask off and how did I get all the way over here type of thing.
Cool.
Well, and the stuff you're talking about earlier about connecting your brain to like project your thoughts and things like that scares me just because I've watched too many Black Mirror episodes. They always end horribly.
Okay, well, it's just, you know, it could happen. It could be quite a good plot for a movie, as you say, like Black Mirror have made an adventure. Okay, so we struggled with that one, and I actually think it's quite interesting that we struggled, because I think it sort of says where we are in terms of what our expectations are for technology. But there we go. Okay, well, we now need to score the movie. So the way we're doing this is what we're saying is, if you were to go back and see the movie again in a theatre, how much would you pay to go and see it again? And the scale is from $0 to $10. What would you pay to go and see it? So, Breffni, you've got the chance to go and see 2001: A Space Odyssey in your local cinema. What would you pay?
So it's my second time to go see the movie, right?
Yep.
I think the only reason I'd be going back to the cinema that week is to get a refund. It was horrendous. So I think purely for the novelty of seeing it on the big screen, and purely for the bit of the music and a bit of the cinematography, which was phenomenal, I'd probably pay about $2.
Okay.
$2, I'd arrive half an hour late, and I'd leave about 2 hours, 10 minutes early. I'd get about 10 minutes. I liked the bit with the Russians. I thought it was really well shot. The set looked amazing. The costumes looked great. Didn't particularly like the way they depicted the women. The women just seemed to be eye candy and not actually part of the show.
Yep.
And I think, that for me would be probably the bit I would watch up to maybe the meeting and moving forward, then kind of when they start going off and they meet and the whole thing kind of crashes and they go back to the Jupiter mission. I just got lost in the middle of all of that. Yeah, $2 probably about the max I'd pay, but okay. I wouldn't be staying for the full movie.
All right. You probably spend more on popcorn than you would on seeing the movie. Yeah.
Well, that happens anyway, let's be honest.
Interesting. Yeah. Peter.
If that extra 17 minutes that apparently what WB has is added to it and maybe cut for time, like maybe cut the or even speed up the acid trip in between Jupiter and the room to make it like maybe only 10 minutes long, I'd say maybe $3.
Okay.
Assuming that the movie theater is using full brightness on their projectors and not 50% like it usually is, where everything seems to be really dark. But yeah, $3.
Okay. Matt.
I was going to go $3 as well, because like you said, if there is a great way to see this movie, it's going to be on the biggest screen possible. So seeing it on like an IMAX, I think that might, it at least entice me. I might also be leaving early on that one, Breffni.
I would stretch to €3 for IMAX. I'm not going to lie.
Okay. So you've got me torn here because I wasn't going to go quite that low. I'm going to go for $5 because I think it is a big screen movie experience. The thing is, I've seen it 6 times already. So about a 7th time might be difficult. So I'm trying to imagine it. But I'm going to go for $5. So we'll leave it there. So that's a 2, 2 threes, and a 5.
And just a side note, when they were talking about the shot of the astronauts or on the moon walking down to where they found the obelisk, mm-hmm. they were saying that Stanley was carrying the 70mm film camera.
Yep.
So that is the IMAX size. So it's not if they still have the source film for that, translating it to IMAX shouldn't be a problem.
IMAX would be particularly good. I've never seen it in IMAX. Okay, good. Well, that averages out at $3.25, so that's our score for this discussion. So thanks very much for that, gentlemen.
And ironically, that could buy you 2 phone calls back home from the space station to Earth.
Oh, now that's a movie geek. Well spotted, absolutely. Yeah, it actually gives the cost of the call, doesn't it? Well done.
How long have you been sitting on that one, Peter?
No, once I said, $1.25. Oh, wow, cool. With the iPhone, it's free, but okay, give your money to AT&T.
Yeah, good. Okay, thank you very much. We've now run out of time, so I'd like to say thanks to our panelists, Matt and Peter, and of course a huge thank you to our guest, Breffni Early. And also, thank you to you, dear listener, for tuning in. Usual thing, we'd love it if you rate and review the show in the usual way. And of course, we'd particularly recommend subscribing so you can be sure of catching all future episodes of Now You've Seen It. If you want to get in touch, you can email us at oraclepodcasts@gmail.com. And we're also on Facebook at facebook.com. Now You've Seen It. You can catch all episodes of Now You've Seen It and some quite other wonderful podcasts at oraclepodcasts.com. And finally, a big thank you to our broadcasting partners at Age of Radio and Galactic Netcasts. And you can find more about them at ageofradio.org, at ageofradio.org and gncasts.com. So again, big thank you to guest and panellists.
Thank you, it was fun.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
And I'm Paul Gisby. This has been Now You've Seen It, the podcast. Thank you and goodbye.
Now You've Seen It is a production of Oracle Media Productions in association with Age of Radio and Galactic Netcasts. For more great podcasts, visit oraclepodcasts.com, ageofradio.org, and gncasts.com.